3CR's Turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.
Virginia Woolf wrote that a feminist is any woman who tells the truth about her life. On today's program, Feminists Making Waves, we'll be hearing some of the debates around feminism that Women on the Line has covered since 1986.
In every era, there is a new silencing, a new form of, frankly, shutting women up.
One of the ways in which women have fought against this silencing has been through articulating feminism, making the status of women and women's experience central to an understanding of the world. Feminism has ever been a contested term, encompassing a contested time frame. Here is Jocelyn Scutt.
Now, women aren't going to be shut up. We never have been shut up, and in fact, we've been active through centuries. One of my pet concerns is this notion of waves of feminism. Now, the problem about the ideology of waves of feminism is that it's a male ideology and it has nothing to do with the reality of women's lives. And the constant is that we are told that each new time that this new wave begins, we have to start off afresh. And if we continue in that vein of accepting that dominant ideology, then we put ourselves into a position of denying our foremothers, denying our own histories or herstories, and actually denying to ourselves a base from which we can move forward.
What is often referred to as the second wave of feminism grew out of the revolutionary spirit of the 1960s. Women who began to identify, challenge, and advocate the overthrow of the social structures and conventions that favoured and maintained male power found themselves supported by a mass movement of women politicised by the necessity for change. A key figure of the women's liberation movement in Australia was Zelda Duprano, a working class woman who in 1969 famously chained herself to the Commonwealth Building in Melbourne to protest unequal pay. Here, Zelda speaks about how her activism grew out of her work in the union movement, where she noticed women weren't speaking up.
And then I realised that there was something really, really wrong. And we realised we had to start a militant women's organisation and we had to fight, never mind about being considered unladylike, you know, that was going to be the least of our problems. We felt we'd been ladylike for far too long. So we formed a Women's Action Committee and we started to do consciousness raising and we started to discuss everything, even why did we get married? What was the true motivation? And because all the things came out, the truth behind why we got married. And this is the first time I ever heard women being really, really honest and examining everything they were doing and why they did it. We had another consciousness-raising session on why we wore makeup, because women are competing with each other for men. And all these things were being analysed and discussed. And this consciousness-raising politicised the women. There was no doubt about it. And what's more, we realised that we had so much in common. Absolutely so much. So this was the process that developed, that made us, for the first time, become very, very aware of the politics of our very being.
In 1970, the publication of Germaine Greer's book, The Female Eunuch, with its themes of sexuality, oppression and liberation, caused shockwaves of recognition in women. Women have very little idea of how much men hate them, Greer wrote, and the words significant and provocative have followed her around ever since. In 1988, she spoke in Canberra.
There's a sort of assumption that, well, that liberation stuff is done. The fact is it hasn't even begun. And if you're talking about women in the community, we are still faced with the problem of child and woman poverty, which has got much worse in our time with the decay of forced cohabitation and support, i.e. with the increasing frequency of divorce. Why are we picking up the tab for that? Why is it being carried out at our expense, this increasing liberty? We were extremely generous, I reckon, those of us who weren't successful in maintaining the androgynous household. One of the things I would like to see in our own time is a more thoughtful approach to segregated society, looking at the way in which it confers power on women and support for the more difficult things that women have to do. We have assumed, for example, that the veil must always be a sign of female subjection. It can also be a sign of female strength. For example, I mean, let me put it in the crudest possible way. We still have a duty of sexual display in our society, and we still make concessions to it. We still are anxious to appear more or less toothsome. And I regard this as a preposterous waste of time. And if I could be relieved of the necessity by being able to toss my chador over my head when I go to the corner shop so I could be even wearing nothing or my nightie underneath, for some of us a chador would be a blessed relief. A blessed relief from the duty of looking nice. I mean, one of the problems about being a feminist is if you don't look nice, they all say, no wonder she's a feminist. So we have to look even nicer. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but it really pisses me off that Gloria Steinem is not allowed to eat. I mean, I regard the right to eat as a basic human right. But for a feminist in New York, for a woman in New York, there is no right to eat. However, I'm actually making a serious point here about anthropology being still male-centred and our studies of societies being still male-centred. I mean, one of the interesting lies that we've all somehow believed is that hunter-gatherer peoples live by hunting. They don't, of course. They live by gathering. But one of the most important things that hunter-gatherer societies have to do is protect the fragile ego of the hunter. And we are all in the same business of protecting fragile egos. And we know that life is not worth living if we don't. That's if we choose to live with men. We still haven't finished analysing how this works, why it is that we have egos that never need support and they have egos that constantly need support. It seems to me the truth lies somewhere in between.
I have this fantasy that the vagina becomes like the next groovy fashion accessory and that women start walking down the street with great kind of gashes of pink and with hair coming out of it and this kind of, you know, great big stylized vaginas around, you know, all over them, on their shoulders and on their breasts and, you know, on, you know, emblazoned on their skirts. I would love that.
Sexuality has been a focus of a feminist analysis of power relations in society and a much contested subject for radical and liberal feminists. Here is Sheila Jeffries in 1991.
All of the social relations of male supremacy, I would argue, are structured around the act of sexual intercourse, because from sexual intercourse arises the heterosexual couple, the nuclear family, gender distinctions, and out of that all of the social relations which construct male supremacy as we know it. I have a feeling this was at one time understood, but we now have much more serious attacks on the understanding that heterosexuality is a political institution. Sexual intercourse in and of itself as a political practice needs to be understood politically as the way in which heterosexuality and the social relations of male supremacy are justified. They're justified by this apparently natural practice, which in my understanding and in the understanding of a lot of feminists is actually contrary to the interests of women in all sorts of important ways. For instance, it's not terribly well related to women's sexual pleasure. It needs the technologizing of women's bodies in order to avoid conception, and it requires contraception and abortion. So there are all kinds of ways in which sexual intercourse is a sexual practice not well suited to the interests of women. I would suggest that sexual intercourse, when women are free, will not be a sexual practice that is done much at all. Hardly ever, I would suggest. Well, I mean, it is a bit weird when you start to think about it.
Dolores French is a feminist and prostitute who founded Hire, Hooking is Real Employment, in the United States. She spoke to Women on the Line in 1989.
One of my first moves towards working for prostitutes' rights was taking a position in the women's rights movement in the United States that was unpopular at the time. But I was very distressed that a feminist movement was excluding women from it, any women, actually, because I felt like that was just feeding into a patriarchal system of dividing women. That attitude, I think, has been one of the reasons that we haven't gotten further than we have with the women's movement. But nonetheless, I felt that women who had had traditional jobs for the past several hundred years, and in some cases thousands of years, such as prostitution, these women should be given a place of honor and respect in the women's movement. Prostitutes are feminists in their own right. And if anything, I felt that we had something to gain from these women.
By 2005, a phenomenon dubbed raunch culture, in which women have embraced a sexual exhibitionism modelled after strippers and porn stars, caused Ariel Levy to write Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture.
What I call raunch culture, women engaging in this, I think it's about apologizing for how far we've come. I mean, I think women have obviously made enormous strides in society in an extremely short period of time, and there's still an incredible amount of anxiety about how do we reassure, you know, men, the people we're trying to declare our independence from, that we're still worth sleeping with. Obviously, there are some women for whom this is authentic, and this is what they want to be doing, and this is real for them. And for them, I think, you know, this is great. You were lucky. You were sort of born at the right time. But I think if you just play the percentages and you think about how many ways there are to be sexual, it's just impossible that this is authentic for everyone, that this is the only thing that there is that's a real representation of female sexuality. So I just felt that it had become so ubiquitous, it started to seem more like an obligation than an option. And if it's not authentic, then it is about performance and not about pleasure. And that's no fun. Sexuality is as wide-ranging as humanity. There's no mold. I mean, that's sort of the point of this book, is that if we're holding up an ideal and it's like stripper, porn star, lusty, busty exhibitionist, that's no more inherently liberating than holding up a model and saying all women should be chaste and angels in the house. I think it should be whatever it is for you. I just think that there should be some emphasis on personal pleasure, and that if you don't have that, you can't possibly call it liberation, which is what we've done. I mean, I think that that's what's depressing about this, is we've pasted the lingo of women's liberation on putting on performances that have very little to do with self-gratification.
Dale Spender spent years taping people's conversations, finding that men did most of the talking. Here she talks about how some people responded to her as a feminist in the 1970s.
As a feminist in the 70s, I was interviewed by men who would say things to me like, "My wife's happy, what's wrong with you?" It's taking any political sense out of women's lives and saying you would only do something personal. And it's also saying that feminism's a total grievance position. It's about women who can't get men. Well, you know, how? You'd have to be a bloody man to think that in the first place. There's such a lack of generosity about women's intellectual contributions. You know, the first wave of feminism were the Rebecca Wests and the suffragettes and people like that. And I can actually remember when I went to interview Rebecca West when she was in her 80s. This was in the early 80s, late 70s. And she was saying to me, you know, you little upstarts, you think you invented it all. And in fact, we did it all 50 years ago and you didn't. And I think it's almost every generation has to restate the truths in their own terms. The younger generation of feminists, and I think this is worth talking about, they're all 30, slim, furious, and absolutely ravishingly beautiful in conventional terms. I mean, they're quite glamorous women. That's not what the second wave feminists were like. I mean, I remember my boiler suits and bobber boots and having my hair shaved almost and not an ounce of makeup or jewellery for about 5 years, whereas the third wave are these very feminine-looking women who say things that I don't think I could ever have said.
Naomi Wolf falls into that third wave category of furious and gorgeous. Her first book, The Beauty Myth, was a searing indictment of the beauty industries. Wolf argued that inflaming women's anxieties about their looks was a new tool of oppression and control. She was in Australia in 1994 to talk about her second book, Fire with Fire.
The premise is that we as women of all races are not a minority, we are the majority, and in first world electoral democracies, we've reached a point in terms of our representation, the structures that 25 years of second wave feminism have built up, and some of our access to the organs of dissemination of information that make it possible for us to shift gears into a proactive feminism and dismantle patriarchy in our time. I mean, dismantle patriarchy and sexist discrimination and sexist oppression. And the question now to ask is, are we ready to use some of the power at our disposal that we have yet to use as fully as we should in order to force equality to happen, whether society, whether the opposition is ready for it or not? An obstacle to our shifting gears into a radical dismantling of patriarchy is that while a majority of women support the broad goals of equality, only a minority are willing to call themselves feminists, right? And so there's been an estrangement between Australian and American women and men who long for gender justice and the movement that claims to represent them. And so part of the critical section of feminism, or of some feminisms in Fire with Fire, talks about how that estrangement came about, addresses issues like women's resentment of what they feel to be litmus test feminism, women's alienation from what they hear as a too reflexive anti-male rhetoric that doesn't distinguish between fighting sexism and hating men as a gender, and particularly a sense among working class women, women of color, and women without a higher education that feminism continues to be a white upper class or upper middle class educated women's movement. How we collude in our own disempowerment sometimes with the evil opposition. It is not an abandonment of the struggle against sexism to also look at and take responsibility for how we internalize those barriers.
You're listening to 3CR's 40 Days of Radical Radio special, celebrating 3CR's 40 fabulous years of community radio.
In 1985, a Harvard-Yale study into marriage patterns in the United States contended that women over the age of 35 have more of a chance of being killed by a terrorist than getting married. Susan Faludi did some digging and found that this claim, like many others about women that had been circulating in the 1980s, was a total myth. She wrote Backlash, The Undeclared War Against Women, and spoke to Women on the Line in 1992.
Why are we getting so much false information? Why is the media misleading us so? And what I concluded was that, as has been the case throughout history, whenever women have made a few steps forward, it seems to inspire in the culture and in the government and in corporations a counter campaign or backlash to put women in their place. Every sector of society participates in the backlash. The media played a central role by passing along two big lies, in a sense. One lie being that women have achieved total equality in the U.S., and two, that as a result of achieving total equality, they were totally miserable. Well, neither of these are true. And if there's anything making women miserable, it's the increasing resistance to their demands for equality, resistance that takes the form of cutbacks in social programs that serve women, or attacks on their right to an abortion and their access to family planning services, or in the rise in sexual violence, which is at unprecedented rates in the United States, as it is in many other countries. One of the most effective ways of undermining the women's rights movement is to alienate women from the movement by giving a false picture of feminism, by heaping on feminism all kinds of negative connotations that have nothing to do with the cause for advancing women's rights. So women are told repeatedly that to be a feminist means to be a man hater or ugly or unfeminine or somebody with a shrieky voice. Anything negative they can think of, they'll attach to feminism. When I saw the beginnings of what were in many ways a repeat of the 50s, those same media messages that feminists are crazy and that feminism is bad for women, I sort of observed all that in horror because I saw what a struggle it was for women like my mother to dig themselves out of that and to launch the second wave of the women's movement, and to think that all of their efforts would be for naught if women of my generation backed off is a large reason why I resolved to write the book.
Backlash rule number one. If anything can go wrong, it will be the fault of feminism and female independence. An important corollary to this rule, whenever possible, frame the women's movement for crimes committed by the backlash. When all else fails, just pretend feminism is dead and maybe it will go away.
I am totally anti-feminism. I think it's like a movement by a bunch of women that are women's livers, and they detest male chivalry and being put in their place and told what roles they have to play and things like that. I think that they carry it too far. I mean, if I couldn't get equality, like if I was discriminated against for going to a job just because I was a woman, I'd get, you know, pretty dark at that. But in regard to other things, I just think it's a waste of time. I think it's really, it's selfish. They're after what they can get and not thinking of how the entire population of women feel. They're just so radical. No, I believe in equal rights, but I'm not a feminist as such.
The alienation of young women from an identification as feminist has been a source of concern, with older feminists chiding the young for taking the gains of feminism for granted and being apathetic about pushing things further. In 1995, Anne Summers wrote an article called Shockwaves at the Revolution, in which she urged young women to make themselves heard. She spoke to Women on the Line in 1997.
Well, what I actually said was that I believe that younger women were interested in the ideas and issues of feminism, and that they did have things to say which would obviously, by definition, be very different from the sorts of things that my generation said. But I was just expressing my frustration that these young women weren't putting their ideas out into the public domain. Sure, there were things being in university publications and small circulation zines and that sort of thing, but those sort of publications are inaccessible to the general population. So I was expressing a plea for at least some of these women to get their ideas into the mainstream where people like me would have access to them. Nobody gets into the media unless they make a noise, and once you make a noise, then there's no trouble about getting onto the media. I mean, my plea was simply to say to these younger women, you know, start making a bit of a fuss so the rest of us can hear what you're saying.
Criticism that young women aren't doing enough tends to make young women mad. Misha Schubert responded to the Anne Summers article.
One of the interesting things that came out of some of Anne Summers' commentary for me was this notion, again, that young women aren't in the public sphere, they aren't in the media, therefore they're not actively organising as feminists, and I think that's quite wrong. Often the work of young women in feminism isn't recorded in an effective way, so we miss them on the public landscape. At the time, I remember feeling rather misrepresented, and what we found with both the established profile of Helen Garner's work and of Anne Summers' work was that it was very difficult for young women to respond on an equal footing to some of the criticisms that were levelled at our generation. And I think young women answered in droves. It was the most letters to the editor that the Good Weekend had ever received in its entire history from many young women, just restating that they were committed to feminism deeply on a personal and political level, that they had a structural analysis, that they were active, but that often they weren't heard.
In 1996, Kathy Bale edited a collection of young women's articulations of feminism for her book, DIY Feminism.
Do-it-yourself was the punk ethos of the 70s. And so I thought that combining this ethos with feminism could be a way of reinvigorating feminism, making women feel that they had a stake in this ideology, which often sort of seems like something that other women do, that's done by professionals. So it was a way to say that individual women can have a role in the feminist movement. And I wasn't proposing a new political philosophy. It's not that complete. It's more like a descriptive label to sum up what younger women are thinking and feeling. And I think it has been taken on as a political philosophy. It's not that at all. It was simply a way to reinvigorate feminism, give it a bit of a kick, make people feel that it was something that was relevant to them and that it could offer tools that they could use in their everyday lives, that it was something that they could carry around with them all the time. Often it's assumed that DIY is an argument for going it alone, for avoiding collective efforts, that it's purely self-serving. It's not that at all. What I'm saying is that get started yourself, and then form alliances, small groups. You don't have to have a public position to start doing something in the feminist area. I want to squash this idea that there is group politics, there's directed, organised politics on the one extreme, and the other extreme is an individualist politics. I don't believe that at all, and that's the way that DIY is often interpreted. I think it's a matter of women organising and working together. But you've got to make that first step. We've got to get women to make that first step. And unfortunately, there are many women who aren't identifying with feminism at the moment and who are taking the sort of path of cautious avoidance rather than activism. And they're the women who I was trying to reach. Just to make the simple point of let's get back to basics and see what you can do in your own situation. Wherever you are, you know, you're going to come across situations where you're going to have to take a feminist stand if you're going to change things, if you're going to make a difference. It's okay to define feminism in your own terms, and you may very well share your ideas with many other women, but it's not sort of this big thing, this big ism that we can't break down. You can come up with your own definition of it. Take what you need from feminism and use it.
Today on Women on the Line, we have been listening to Feminists Making Waves. And the last word goes to Zelda DiPrano.
It's not like an organisation. Because there's no presidents and there's no structure and there's no hierarchy, I don't think anything is the best way. I think women have to hammer wherever they are. I'm not going to turn around and say to any woman, you should be doing this. What I do say is that wherever you are, you have to try whatever you can do to change it.
That's all for this instalment of On the Record, 20 years of women's radio. Thanks to all past presenters and contributors of Women on the Line. There are 8 parts to this series, and if you missed any of them, you can download them from our website, www.womenontheline.org.au, or order a copy from 3CR on 03 9419 8377. Thanks to the Victorian Women's Trust for funding this historic project. The theme music has been Chop In by Minimum Chips. I'm Eleanor McInerney, and to finish up today's program, we will hear the Femocrat song, sung by the Melbourne Short Women's Choir.
Try to change the system, sisters, don't let it change you. Women can be bored in boardrooms, we and all sisters do. If the work you do's inhuman, then some changes should be looming. So you can try to change the system, sisters, don't let it change you. By changing the bureaucracy. But it seems that while I've only started to climb, there's a man at the top of each tree. In moments of doubt and alarm, I think I'll reach out to a farm. But that's just the dream of a girl in midstream, because action has still got its charm.
CR's turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.